Thanks so much, Jacques, and thank you everyone for coming tonight. I want to start tonight at the end of the story. This folio, this single page, contains one of the first, if not the first, translation of the New Testament, one manuscript of it. And it was discovered not in the sands of Egypt, not in a monastery on the top of Mount Sinai, but in central Minnesota, 2.5 hours north of here. One of only 5 incomplete copies of the world's first translation of the Christian Bible. Tonight I'm going to tell you the story of not only what this is, but I'm going to really focus on how this is important for biblical studies. I'm a historian. I'm fascinated by history in its own right. I find the history of the church intrinsically interesting. But I want to talk about tonight specifically, as a trained New Testament scholar, how New Testament scholars use this kind of material to shed light on, to come to understand the Bible. And then we'll touch on as much as can be told of how this thing ended up in central Minnesota, 2.5 hours from here. Growing up in the Midwest, I knew there were 2 kinds of Christianity. There are Catholics and there are Christians, right? And my conception of church history was something like this, right? It starts with Jesus, and then there's the Roman Catholic Church, and then there's Martin Luther in the 16th century, and he gives us, and we get from that Protestantism, right? This was a conception of church history that I had, I know, for a good period of time. And it wasn't until, I think, undergrad, perhaps a high school course, where I took a European history course, and I learned there was a wider church, right? I learned about the 11th century schism, the Filioque controversy, the East and the West, the Latin West and the Greek East split over this, well, ostensibly over a single term in the Nicene Creed, but they split over a bunch of things, and the catalyst was this one fight over the wording of the Nicene Creed. So I came to have something like this for my conception of church history, right? We have a unified church until 1054, and then the Greek East splits from the Latin West. We have our Orthodox, or Eastern Orthodox with a capital O, churches, and our Western churches. What Pope John Paul II, in his push, his laudable push for ecumenical dialogue, calls the 2 lungs of the church. That is, 2 traditions that give us, that each give us important parts of intellectual Christian history, that each give us, make contributions to the life of the church. And that gives us a map of something like this, right? The 2 hemispheres of Christianity. And this is fairly serviceable for European history. But there's something a little strange. This map centers Rome, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. But Rome is roughly, you know, somewhere between Rome and Constantinople is, we find, the center of this map. But if you've read the book of Acts, Christianity doesn't start in Rome, right? Nor is Rome the headquarters of the church for the first century. You'd find that in Jerusalem, all the way over here. And if we reimpose our map of the 2 hemispheres of the church, this produces something strange. This, it seems that what we have is the start, the origin point, the headquarters of the early church on the far right edge, say perhaps the margin of the Christian world. Did Christians go north and south and west, but never east? Did nobody ever think to turn right? Well, in fact, they did, of course. That's the point of my talk. And not only did they turn right, but this, what I'm calling tonight, the other early church, what Sebastian Brock, a famous scholar of Syriac Christianity, has called the church's supernatural third lung, playing off of Pope John Paul II's The Two Lungs of Christianity. This Syriac tradition is actually the most geographically widespread of any of the ancient Christian traditions. In terms of who traveled the furthest, who reached the most geographic coverage, the Syriac wins. And as far as we know, Syriac studies is actually pretty young, but as far as we know, Syriac right now has the third largest collection, the language of Syriac has the third largest collection of early Christian literature, following after Greek and Latin. So, thinking of our third lung gives us a different image of Christian history. We need to go all the way back to the 5th century, to the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon in 431 and 451, to see where the united Greek East and Latin West split off from the Syriac East. This story is very complicated, and we can talk about Christological debates, the debates with Nestorius of the Council of Ephesus that led eventually to the split off of the Church of the East, which is the light green line at the bottom, and later debates, the Chalcedonian debates over monophysitism, debates about the nature of the incarnation that led to the splitting of these churches. But I don't want to spend all night splitting hairs on Christology, happy to discuss that during the Q&A. But let it be said that what these churches share in common is the Council of Nicaea. They share the first three church councils, the Council of Nicaea and the Council of Constantinople. So the Nicene Creed that we say at my church every week is also confessed happily by all the Christian traditions we're discussing today. So everyone is Trinitarian. They have slightly different language for talking about Christology, but if we did talk about that, we'd have to talk about this, which is those nice, neat lines, as you know, for the blue Greek and the red Latin and the green Syriac. They represent really a cluster, right? So these are the different branches of the Syriac Church, which we do not have time to find. You can find this particular map on Wikipedia. Let's back up. What is Syriac? Syriac is a Semitic language. It's part of the northwest branch of Semitic languages. So it's close cousins with Hebrew, with Arabic, and it is a dialect, so it's more than a close cousin, it's actually a dialect, a sub-dialect of Aramaic. Jesus spoke Aramaic. The Syriac that was being spoken in the first century in Edessa, which is the headquarters of the Syriac Church, and the Syriac that was being spoken in Jerusalem and Galilee, or the Aramaic that was being spoken in Jerusalem and Galilee, were mutually intelligible. And as we'll see later, some Syriac Christians believe that Jesus actually corresponded with Christians in Edessa. Probably not true, but we'll talk about it. Here's the alphabet, but you never actually see it looking that way, because Syriac is a cursive script. So this is what actual Syriac looks like. This is the Estrangula hand, the oldest of the Syriac hands. The city in red on my map is Edessa, and Syriac is the dialect of Aramaic that developed in this city. This was the central city that ran a kingship, a kingdom that was not part of the Roman Empire. So these are neighbors of the Roman Empire. And at some point, it's hard to say when, but we'll talk about that. At some point, this kingdom became Christian. And the dialect of Aramaic they spoke there, which we now call Syriac, came to dominate because it was the politically powerful entity in that region. So Antioch, where Christians were first called Christians, is just west of Edessa. And they spoke a form of Syriac there, when we have evidence of early Christianity there from outside the Bible. We have witnesses to early 3rd century, 3rd or 4th century Christians who are preaching in Greek and in Syriac there, right there in Syrian Antioch. How did Christianity arrive in the Syriac East? If you asked an ancient Syriac Christian, they would have told you a story, the story of Abgar. This story can be found in Eusebius's church history, and this story can be found in a foundational document. It's not scriptural, it's not authoritative, but it is an important document for Syriac Christians called the Teaching of Adai. And Adai is the Syriac name for Thaddeus, one of the disciples. So Adai, Thaddeus, same guy. And in this story, Jesus writes a letter, the king of Edessa writes a letter to Jesus saying, "I hear you're not getting along with your fellow countrymen. Would you like to come here, please?" And Jesus politely responds in a letter, "No, thank you. I have to die, but I will send you one of my disciples." And this disciple, of course, is Thaddeus. Now, every kind of ancient Christianity has a story kind of like this. And most of them, possibly a few exceptions, most of them historians don't find credible. These are the kinds of stories Christians told themselves. But this is an important story for them. And it might reflect a few shades of truth, because all the kings in Edessa for several generations called themselves Abgar. And when we start looking for the historical origins, I'll come back to the Odes of Solomon, but the first Syriac Christian we know of is a man named Bar Dison. And we have one of his writings, but more importantly, we have another historian describing Bar Dison as a follower, part of the entourage of Abgar, the king of Edessa. This is the great-grandson, or the grandson maybe, of that first Abgar who was supposed to have written a letter to Jesus. But it's really quite possible that Christianity came to Syria quite early under a man named Abgar. So this legend might have developed out of something plausible. Christianity came to Syria under Abgar, which Abgar, well, obviously the one that was alive while Jesus was alive. It's one reconstruction, but it seems plausible to me. If we back up and look for the historical origins of Christianity, the first text we find is something called the Odes of Solomon. And this text is impossible to date because it doesn't contain references to kings or politics. It's a collection of songs. It's the first hymn book we have for all of Christianity. And it quite plausibly dates to the end of the first century or sometime in the second century. Christians in the second century seem to know this. Really difficult to date, but this is our first collection of Christian songs, and it's preserved in Syriac. We then find this Bishop Paulut, who we can definitely pin. He was a bishop, he had a church there, and one of his churches was destroyed by a flood. We have secular historians describing the destruction of a church in Edessa in 201. So at this point, they're big enough that they actually have buildings, which there's actually not a good lot of reason to think they had buildings yet anywhere in the Roman Empire. That's really difficult to try to figure out when you start having buildings. But there's good reason to think they had a infrastructure in Syria at least as early as anywhere else. Drink some water. So I'm a biblical scholar, not a Syriacist, so I can't give you a full history of Syriac Christianity, or at least that's not what I'm going to do. But you should be aware of at least three important Syriac thinkers. The furthest to the left is a man named Ephrem the Syrian. He is the sort of Augustine of Syriac, right? He is the figure that all Syriac Christians look back to. They all respect him. And he wrote a ton of literature. He writes lots of poetry, which is one... For us, that sounds like an artist or something, but poetry was didactic in the ancient world. We have medical poems. How does a doctor learn the different parts of the body? Well, you pick up a didactic poem on anatomy, and that's how they taught things. So Ephrem not only gives us beautiful poems of worship, but also gives us the Hymns Against Heresy, where he lays out in a beautifully structured poem why Marcion is wrong about everything. Marcion's a famous heretic. And he gives us hymns on all sorts of systematic theology. Isaac of Nineveh is a fairly well-known theologian of the 7th century. And then Aphrahat is the first Syriac writer, slightly before Ephrem, we have any substantial corpus of writings from. We could go on all night. I mean, like, Try imagine giving one slide for the intellectual history of Latin. Like, this is impossible. We could talk about Jacob of Edessa. We could talk about Narsai. That'll have to be a different talk. But you should know about these individuals. Just a word on the spread of Christianity, of Syriac Christianity. This green oval is obviously an approximation, but it's not an exaggeration. This is, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of a Chinese word, but this is Xian. Thank you. Xian Stili, which is found sort of in central China. I'm going to say there, roughly. And what you find, it is erected in 781, and you find along the bottom of it, Syriac. The whole stele is a catalog of Syriac bishops distributed throughout China. Similar stories could be told about Christians in southern India. The so-called St. Thomas Christians, who still exist in southern India, that's Syriac Christianity. And lest we think we're talking about a historical artifact, it's worth noting these are real, living, breathing traditions today. That diagram of Syriac churches, each one of those branches still exists. Many of them live in places where they are being actively persecuted. The southern border of Turkey is where Edessa now lies. The current political regime has not been friendly towards their Syriac neighbors. Here's a sense of the spread of current Syriac churches and traditions. We find them in Mongolia, we find them in China, southern India, and of course over in modern day Syria and Israel. I had a chance to spend a summer actually up in Himmel, which I'll talk about later, this monastery up north, several years ago with a Syriac refugee who had his world destroyed from the civil war in that country. So still very much a living, breathing tradition. Okay, so I'm here to talk to you about the relevance of the Syriac Bible for biblical studies. I'm going to pass around a Peshitta Bible. I'll explain what that is in a second, but this is a Syriac Bible. This is probably the main Syriac Bible used liturgically. That's complicated, but it's take a look and you can see the script and consider it. And I want to do this under three headings. So for each subject we come across, I want to talk about how Syriac Christianity can help us understand the text of the Bible, can help us understand the translation of the Bible, and can help us understand the interpretation of the Bible. This is a neat way to organize things. These are necessarily intersecting categories, right? To make a textual choice or a translation choice involves interpretation and vice versa. But these are the headings under which I want to discuss the Syriac Bible. I don't want to presume too much knowledge in the room, so just caveat, you can check out for a second if you know this, but the Christian Bible is composed in basically two languages. The Christian Old Testament is composed in Hebrew, Biblical Hebrew, Classical Hebrew, and the Christian New Testament is composed in Greek. We call it Koine, or common Greek. The nerds in the room will say, but there's Aramaic chapters in Daniel and Ezra. And yes, you're right. There's something called Imperial Aramaic, which is a very, very close cousin of Syriac. We have a couple chapters of these books and some smattering of Aramaic throughout the rest of the Old Testament. And we might also note that certain books of certain Christian Old Testaments, what we think of as the Deuterocanon or the Deuterocanons, were composed in Greek. The first part of the Syriac Bible we should talk about, this is an image from the Mosul Church of St. Thomas, preserved by Himmel. And I wanted to start with this one. Because you have the fingers of the monk who owns this Bible and kept this Bible still showing on the page. What the Hill Manuscript Museum and Library does, which we'll talk about more fully, is they go photograph things and leave them in situ, which is part of the reason they've been able to photograph so much stuff. But the Syriac Old Testament, this word peshitta means common. It's almost an exact equivalent in several ways with the word Vulgate. So if you think of the Vulgate Bible, that's the Latin Bible that the Church of the West has used for 1,000+ years now. That word Vulgate comes from vulgar, meaning popular. Peshitta, likewise, means popular. So this is the common Bible, the popular Bible. All those splitting branches of Syriac Christianity, the Peshitta Bible was translated before all of them, and so it's something they all hold in common. Later translations were made sometimes in the tensions between different kinds of churches, and so they're not the Vulgate, right? They're not the Peshitta. So Peshitta is going to show up a couple times in this lecture, and whenever I say it, it means it's the popular one. The Peshitta Old Testament is really fascinating and arguably more important for the study of the Old Testament than the Syriac Bible is for the New. But I'm a New Testament scholar, so I'm going to start and focus on the New Testament. What I want to say about the Old Testament before we move on is one of the things that makes this distinctive is this probably wasn't translated by Christians. The Peshitta Old Testament was a translation of the Hebrew Bible by Jews for Jews, and Christians took it over from the Syriac-speaking Jewish community, which is a really, it's an interesting control on other forms of the Bible that come down to us. So we'll come back to that at the end of the lecture if we have time. I'm going to focus today on the Syriac New Testament, or at least use that to introduce the concepts we're talking about. I'm going to talk about the Syriac New Testament in four stages. We could add a few to this, but we need to simplify. The Peshitta lies third. So the Peshitta translation is produced, some of the New Testament is produced by Christians, obviously. This is the Christian Bible, the Christian New Testament, sometime around the 5th century. And then thereafter, in the 7th century, we have the production of the Harclean. I'm doing these pretty quick because we're not going to really focus on these. We're going to focus on the really early translations. But the Harclean is a second translation produced by a man named Thomas of Harkle. He went to Egypt and he was frustrated with all the versions that came before. And he wanted a version that looked exactly the same as what Greek Christians he was encountering were using. So he goes and produces a translation of the Syriac Bible representing the Greek word for word in Greek word order. And if you speak any two languages, you know that's going to produce nonsense in the target language. A little harsh to say the Harclean is nonsense, but it definitely isn't normal Syriac. So the Harclean is what we think of as a scholarly tool for Syriac scholars to access what the Greeks are reading. And it's a tool in more than one way, because the Harclean manuscripts we receive all have marginal notes noting where different versions of the Bible have different readings. This is a sort of critical edition or scholarly edition of the New Testament produced in the 7th century, which is cool. The two older translations I want to talk about, I'm going to focus mostly on the Old Syriac today, but it's worth noting that the first form of the Bible that comes into Syria for the Gospels has something called the Diatessaron. That Teaching of Adai document, that 4th, 5th century document that tells the story of Abgar, this foundational document, it describes a church service. The disciples of Thaddeus meet together. So again, we're talking about a semi-legendary document. But the disciples of Thaddeus meet together for a church service, and together they commit themselves to reading the New Testament, namely the Diatessaron and the letters of Paul. The Diatessaron is a harmony of the four canonical Gospels. It literally, dia means through, and tesseron means four. And the name probably comes from Eusebius, who says the author of the Diatessaron, a man named Tatian, combined the Gospels so it could, composed the Gospels read through four, through the four. So it is both in its name, but in its form, a combination of the Gospels. So we don't have any copies of this, but we have commentaries written on this by Syriac church fathers. And if you read them, It goes straight from John 1 to Luke 1, back to John, back to Luke, into Matthew. It's a very interesting artifact of the early church. But the Syriac Christians didn't have only this. Pretty quickly, they also produced the Old Syriac translations of the four Gospels, which I'll show you the manuscript later that has the title of this, but they called these the Gospels of the Separated. The first copy we have this called them the Separated Gospels, and we find at the same time the Diatessaron gets called the Gospel of the Mixed. And so you've got two kinds of Gospels people are using, and a lot of Christians seem to be using both. Ephrem writes a commentary on the Diatessaron, but also in his hymns we'll talk about the four evangelists and the rivers that flow from them. So Christians are using both. They find them both useful. There's a bishop named Rabula, and he's alive in the 5th century along with another bishop named Theodoret, and they both make an effort to get all Christians over to using the Old Syriac separated Gospels. So that seems to be when the trail for the Diatessaron runs dry. Enough on that. I'm going to focus on the Old Syriac and how we use that to understand the Bible today. This is Dyer al-Suryan, which is Arabic. I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation, but it's Arabic for the Church of the Syrians. And it's found in Egypt, and it's called this because it contains a wealth of Syriac literature. One monk named Moses, Musha, travels to Baghdad, I think it is, in the 11th century, and brings back with him 250 manuscripts, which contain copies of the Bible, contain early Syriac church writings. He brings them to this monastery, and there they sit today. Well, they would, except for British occupation of Egypt, which scatters them all over Europe, which we're going to talk about in a second. But that's where a lot of these documents come from. William Cureton is a curator of the British Museum, and he is going through the holdings of the British Library and discovers this manuscript, taken from Dyer al-Suryan. I actually don't know whether it was purchased or what happened there. Taken from Dyer al-Suryan, and it is the top there, across the top. Let's see if my letter laser works. Ha. Evangelion. I can't even read it. It's blocked up. So it says the Gospel of the Mixed dot Matthew. So we have here the Mixed Gospels, and this is what comes to be known as the Kiritonian Syriac. Even bigger. Mefrasha is the Syriac word, the Gospels, the Gospel of the Mixed Ones. The word mixed is plural, so mixed stories, I'm getting it separated. This is the Gospel of the Separated. This is the four separated Gospels. It's the Gospels of the Separated. So here we have the first known manuscript of the Old Syriac Gospels. A little bit later, two sisters, Margaret Gibson and Lewis Smith is her last name. I forget her first name. But two sisters are traveling around the Middle East, and they go to St. Catherine's Monastery here on top of Mount Sinai, and there they discover a palimpsest, another manuscript. Has anyone ever heard the word palimpsest before? A palimpsest is an erased text that has been written over. So this is the book they find here, Syriac 30, is what's called the Book of the Women. It's a collection of saints' lives and biblical women's stories. That's the text you can read there in the print. But if you look really closely, you can see there's a text behind that. In fact, there's a number of different texts that when the scribe produced this Book of the Women, which is the text you can see, they erased several other texts that weren't being used and copied over the top of them. And with modern technology, we can now scan these and have the computer pick out certain elements that are used in certain kinds of dye, kinds of ink. The red you see here now, the black is the overtext. The red you see is our second copy of the Old Syriac Gospels. The first one, the Kiritonian, contains less than half of the four complete Gospels, just less than half is preserved, and this one contains a little over half. And so if you want to read the Sinaitic palimpsest, you have to read this red text. Now, British, shall we call them collectors, preservers, I'm not sure, librarians, had a different technique. They didn't have computers, but they discovered that if you pour certain kinds of chemical onto the manuscript, it'll react with the underneath ink. And there's a description. You can read the sisters, the Smith and Gibson sisters, you can read their account of doing this and other and other historians, other librarians. They would pour something on this, and it makes the underlying ink bubble up. And it's like, they describe it like the word of God, you know, coming to light out of the manuscript, and it only lasts for a few minutes, and then it fizzles out. In doing that, it's reacting with something, destroying the manuscript. There are significant portions of this that are totally illegible because this reactive agent has been poured over it over and over again. This is in the process of being re-edited. A scholar named David Taylor is currently producing a brand new edition of this. And I had lunch with him a year or so ago, and he was saying how certain parts of the manuscript are completely uneditable. All you can do now is just cite the editions. The manuscript has been totally destroyed in terms of legibility. In any case, we have here our second copy of the Old Syriac Gospels. If you're interested in those Sinai sisters, as they're sometimes called, you can read a book called The Sisters of Sinai by look up The Sisters of Sinai. She's at Duke now. She came just as I was leaving. But she writes a great great narrative about their life of scholarship and all the wealth of manuscripts they discovered. Here's what it looks like blown up. It's actually not impossible to read. You can make it out. It just takes time and patience. Kimin. I'm not going to keep doing that. That's no one finds that helpful. Okay, so translation. How do scholars use the Old Syriac? One way we can use that is as a help for the act of translating. So we have the text in front of us. In fact, I'm not sure how many people know what a critical edition is, so I just want to say what that is. This is Nestle Aland 28, and it's the current critical edition we use for the Greek New Testament. And what a critical edition means, as opposed to just an edition or a diplomatic edition, is the text represented on this page doesn't correspond to any one manuscript in the world, any one manuscript that's ever existed. What we've done instead is taken lots of manuscripts, compared them, and printed the best readings, according to a group of scholars in Germany, the best manuscripts, and printed what we think the best text is across the top. And then at the bottom of each page, you'll find what's called the apparatus. And this is citing all the manuscripts that they think are relevant. There's way too many New Testament manuscripts to even cite. But all the manuscripts they feel are relevant for and against each reading that was chosen. So I'm just going to pass this around. If anyone's never seen a critical edition of the New Testament, that's cool to look at. But so we have there the critical text. So they're looking at the critical text and they're asking themselves, how do we translate this into good English? And there's a fascinating case study I want to pull up here, which is the word daily in the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. Matthew has, give us our daily bread today. Luke has, give us our daily bread each day. That word daily is the same. That's the bit I care about, right? Now, this word in Greek is epiousion. Epiousion. And in all surviving Greek literature, no one before Matthew and Luke ever used this word. This word does not appear in any text before Matthew and Luke. And the greatest scholar of the early church, one of the greatest expert in Greek literature, Origen of Alexandria, who himself prepared a kind of critical edition of the Bible, fascinating scholar, did all kinds of interesting work. In his treatise on prayer, he says that this is a word invented by the evangelists, that the word wasn't used by any earlier authors, and he, a native Greek speaker who lives in Alexandria, the center for Hellenistic thought, doesn't think this word is used by anyone else. So this word is what's called a hapex legomena, a word that shows up once. Now, for the record, we're not completely out at sea figuring out words like this. There's lots of these in the Hebrew Bible, which is a much more complicated corpus, where we don't have a lot more comparative literature. We can do things like comparing other related languages, and you can break apart parts of words. So it's not like scholars are just totally guessing with this kind of thing. But besides doing the etymology thing, you can do something much better, is you can look at how early readers of this text translated this word into other languages, right? So that's what the Syriac is, right? The Syriac, along with the Latin, are the first two times the New Testament is translated into another language. So we can go see what, let's say, St. Jerome. What does St. Jerome translate this? So this word shows up once in Matthew, once in Luke, each in the Lord's Prayer, and St. Jerome gives a different translation of the same word between the two Gospels. This word daily, or epousion, in Matthew, he translates as the supersubstantial bread. I don't know what that means. it seems to connote something like supernatural. It has some sort of supernatural quality. It's the substance, and it's the thing that is above the substance. I'm not sure what that really means. In Luke, he translates the same word, quotidianum. And this is actually pretty close to how what we call the Old Syriac, the Syriac translations that existed before Jerome. The Latin translations that existed before Jerome, they give pretty much the second translation, which we get the word quotidian from. It means ordinary, usually, but it's actually related to our word for day. So it's the bread of the day as opposed to some kind of special bread. So in a way, these are actually kind of opposite translations. Supersubstantial suggests it's supernatural bread, and quotidian bread suggests it's normal bread. What's the point? Jerome doesn't really know what this word means. or at least he changes his mind between Gospels. So let's go ask our Syriac brothers and sisters in Christ. The Old Syriac Sinaiticus is all that survives for this part of Matthew. The Kirtonian doesn't exist in this section. And it gives the constant bread, both in Matthew and in Luke. This is something like enduring bread. And it has to be said, this is a very plausible understanding of what that word epiusion means, just based on the different parts of the word. The Syriac Peshitta, so this means something like bread that lasts, bread that endures, bread that perseveres. Peshitta gives actually another very plausible reading, the bread of need, the bread that we need for the day. Give us the bread that we need today, and do it either today or every day, right, between Matthew and Luke. So this, I think, there's nothing obliging Bible scholars to agree with the Syriac. That's not how, you know, accumulating evidence works. But we here see two very plausible readings of the etymology, and we know there are ancient Christians in the 3rd and in the 5th century who know these languages, know these cultures better than we do, who think it might mean one of these two things. That doesn't give us the answer. That's not how scholarship works. What it does do is it gives us some really interesting evidence for thinking about plausible translations of this. And on the historian side, it also tells us how Christians have read their Bible for 1,500 years. 1,500 years of Christians opened up their Bible and read the bread that we need, the bread of need. I'm on a day-themed streak. I didn't get the translation. So this is the words of the criminal on the cross, right? This is the words of Jesus to the criminal hanging next to him in the Gospel of Luke. And you can translate it one of two ways. And he said to him, is the top of that, "Amen, I say to you," and then you have the word today, and then you have the rest of his speech. "With me, you will be in paradise." And there's a question. Does the word today attach to I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise? Or does it attach to you will be with me in paradise today? It's right between them. It's an adverb. It can go either way. And there's no hard and fast rule in Greek telling you which way to go. I think there's one that's more plausible than the other, but you don't care about what I think today. We're going to talk about the Syriac. And The Syriac cannot preserve the ambiguity, because Syriac has this little letter down here. It's called a dalet, the one I've got the red arrow pointing to. And this functions, it's a discourse marker. It tells you where the reported speech starts and stops. So in their language, they need to decide. And in fact, the different Syriac authors give us different decisions. The Peshitta goes with the text we're probably used to thinking with. Amen, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. But the Old Syriac, the oldest form of Syriac, actually goes with the other one. It puts the discourse marker after the word today. So in the oldest translation of this passage in Syriac, he says, Amen, I say to you, today, you will be with me in paradise. Again, no obligation to agree with this translator. You may have good reasons to argue one way or the other, but it is relevant evidence the biblical scholars do use to figure out how to translate. So this is the blown-up page of the critical edition. We were passing this around. I scanned this morning of my Gospel of Luke. And we have here Luke 3, 21. This is the baptism of Jesus. So the critical text is printed above. The apparatus with select representative manuscripts are printed down here in the apparatus. We're going to talk about the words announced from heaven in Jesus' baptism. So, you are my son, the beloved. With you I'm well pleased. That's what's printed in many Bibles, and that's what's printed in the critical text. It's what you'll find at the top of the text. But they print it with these, well, in the English translation, this is the NRSV, they've got a little footnote. You should start reading the footnotes in your Bible. They're really interesting. That little letter A. And in the critical edition, they print it with these little carrots. I don't know what you call those. Little pseudo boundary markers. And what that's telling you to do is go look at your apparatus. And what you find there is an extra phrase. You are my son, the beloved. Sounds like an allusion to a psalm, Psalm 2:7. And what we find is that certain manuscripts of the Bible, listed down here below, so the capital letter D, that's Codex Baeza. This IT means it's the old, let's see here, the old Latin, and then Justin Martyr. So a few manuscripts print the rest of that psalm in the baptism. So you have, you're my son, the beloved. You're my son, today I have begotten you. Which finishes the quotation, but is potentially problematic theologically. Now, lots of Christians knew the text this way and didn't have a problem being Orthodox and reading the text this way. But there's a famous Bible scholar in North Carolina who thinks this was the original text and was erased by Orthodox Christians trying to preserve the orthodoxy of the Bible. I think he's wrong, but we're just going to look at the evidence today. So here we have the, I didn't provide translations here, we have the Syriac witnesses, two of them, and both of them preserve the shorter text. This is one argument that I think very plausibly counts as evidence that the shorter text, without that today I've begotten you, was in fact the original. And someone came along later and thought, oh, we should complete the psalm quotation, and added it in. In any case, this is a place where the Syriac has, for some scholars, if you go read the commentary on how the committee made the textual judgments, the Syriac plays a large role in weighing against following the old Latin translation and that Codex Baeza, which is one of the earliest manuscripts of the Bible. So it's a powerful argument for the longer text. But the fact that another Christian in the other part of the world preserves the same text, so it's kind of hard to explain this. So the logic is, if that longer text was original and someone edited out because they didn't like it, They have to somehow go get their copies that are already in Syria outside of the Roman Empire, heading east towards China, and get those fixed. That's really hard to do. And so when the Syriac and the Latin agree, then that ends up being pretty powerful evidence, because those are not traditions that are often in communication. But here they don't. And so this is a powerful argument, actually, for the shorter text. One more text variant, one I'm particularly fond of. In Mark 1:41, here I've printed the New International Version and the ESV. And if you compare these, this is a man with leprosy has came up to Jesus and asked to be healed. And depending on which Bible translation you're reading, it either says Jesus was indignant, Jesus becomes angry, or Jesus was moved with pity. Same verse, same gospel, two different English stories. Stories is strong. Two different reactions from Jesus. This is not a translation issue. There is no Greek underlying word that's ambiguous. This is a textual issue. So if we looked up Mark 1:41 in that edition that's going around, we find this word printed, splagnikthes, which means to have compassion, but with a little hat, and we go down in the apparatus, and we find orgisthes as a variant, which means to be angry. So our oldest manuscripts of this, Codex Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, both read compassion, and one of our other oldest manuscripts reads to be angry in Greek. So this is a question of which text was there first and which one replaced it. And until, so here we go, here's the two representatives. We have the words orgisthes and splagnisthes in their respective Greek texts, anger and pity. And for a long time, in fact, until 2017, scholars have said the Syriac supports compassion. We have the same actual groups of agreements. We have, just like the baptism, we have this one Greek manuscript and the Latin tradition going with anger, and everybody else does compassion. Until 2017, when Sebastian Brock announced the discovery of a brand new third Old Syriac gospel on St. Catherine's, in Mount Sinai, at St. Catherine's Monastery. And this manuscript contains both readings. Now Jesus had compassion on him, and being angry, stretched out his hand. This is the only manuscript in the whole world that has both. What has happened here? Probably the translator, this 3rd century Syriac Christian, when he was translating, had multiple Greek manuscripts in front of him. And what we find out is that probably he had his manuscripts didn't agree here. He's created what's called a conflate reading, and there are other examples of this, where he saw the two readings, he didn't know which one to pick, so he combined them. This creates an inverse of the situation with the baptism. We now have Old Latin and Old Syriac on opposite sides of the world agreeing with each other. It's difficult evidence to know what to do with. I don't honestly have a strong preference between the variants. There's also, it's worth mentioning, a bunch of unique readings that are found in the Old Syriac. When this shows up, no one in their right mind thinks a unique reading is the reading that goes back to the biblical authors. That would be wild. But what it does sometimes indicate is really interesting information about reception history, about how Christians were reading this, and the evidence it can tell us about that. So this is one I'm actually writing an article on right now. Jesus in his trial before Pilate, the New Finds Old Syriac manuscript says he was silent as if he wasn't there. Brand new manuscript, brand new reading, I've never been seen before, except I stumbled across an old Latin manuscript that has the same reading in it. And to my knowledge, no one's ever noticed this before. You have an old Syriac and an old Latin manuscript, the two first translations of the Bible, that have this random variant. And I weirdly discovered this while watching Jesus Christ Superstar. And if you know that song that he sings, Jesus in that musical says this exact same line. There's no way in the world that Tim Rice, who wrote the lyrics for Jesus Christ Superstar, saw either of these manuscripts. This seems to be a thing that people across history and across time feel like completes the line. So I'm going to be arguing that actually this isn't a witness to some forgotten, long-lost variant reading from Greek manuscripts that are going to shake up the translation world. This is actually just a sort of rhetorical tag, something that made sense to different Christians at different times, including in the 1970s, to add, to sort of round out the scene. But, I don't know, we'll see. All right, so our manuscripts have come from a monastery in Egypt, the monastery of the Syrians, our Curatonian Old Syriac. They've come from St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai, Cyrenaic Palimpsest. And now, all of a sudden, a new manuscript is found in central Minnesota, 45 minutes outside of St. Cloud. This is St. John's University. It's a gorgeous place. I woke up there this morning. If you've never had a chance to visit, this church, put in any city of the world, would be one of the most famous churches in the world, I think. It is a really stunning place to be. And in the basement, they have the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library. After World War II, the Benedictines, who ran this place, who at one time this was the largest Benedictine monastery in the world, in the 60s, they were worried about the destruction of intellectual heritage, of cultural history, following World War II. And so they made it their mission to try to preserve as much of it as possible. So they started driving around in Volkswagen camper vans, there's a great picture of this, photographing everything in the most endangered part of the world, Eastern Europe. I guess that joke worked better before the invasion of Ukraine. But like they photographed stuff in Poland and in Finland. More recently, they've continued doing this since, I think, the 60s. They've continued doing this, and Father Columba has been behind enemy lines in Iraq, in Syria, while ISIL was in control there. He's lately been in Ukraine, and they train the locals to digitize things and preserve them. And I don't know if you know about the history of those areas, but many of those libraries are completely destroyed. And Himmel in northern Minnesota contains some of the last records, contains photographs of complete manuscript libraries that we know are now gone. And so the only record of thousands and thousands of manuscripts are kept on their computer servers. Just in 2022, a scholar named Gregory Kissel announced that while one of their curators there, a man named Matthew Heitzelman, was wandering around their vault, he picked up some papers and found under it a single leaf. And this single leaf, Gregory Kissel identified as belonging to a Georgian liturgical text from the 10th century. We don't know how it got there, but this Georgian liturgical text is famous for containing, it's a palimpsest, and its undertext contains 26 different texts underlying it that have been erased and rewritten as this Georgian liturgical text. And when Professor Kessel first published this, it hit the news. Scientists have discovered an ancient hidden chapter of the Bible. Erased 1,750-year-old New Testament translation using ultraviolet photography. I like this one. New chapter of the Bible discovered. ancient Bible fragment found confirming old Syriac version. Confirming? This is not what happened. What they discovered was a new, never before, on this single page, a new, never before seen copy of the old Syriac Gospels. So it was translated in the 3rd century. The earliest manuscripts we have of it are from the 5th. This text is another 5th century copy of it. And you might have remembered mentioning that none of the copies we have are complete. There are whole portions of the Gospels where we do not have the text of the Old Syriac. So finding a new copy is kind of a big deal. This is me looking at it. I posed. So there it is. It's actually pretty big as far as fragments go. Here it is. The text you see is a Georgian liturgical manuscript. And if you look down the middle, you might see an erased text. That is not the gospel. That is a church history of Theodoret, produced in the 7th century. The scribe who copied that text created a palimpsest. He erased a copy of the Gospels, wrote the church history on top of it, which was subsequently erased a second time to write the Georgian text in the 10th century. It's a double palimpsest. So you have your scans here. You can see the church history down the middle in three nice columns. Not the old Syriac Gospels. And it took me a very long time to find where the old Syriac was. It's down here. And let's see here. It's right there. So just parts of a word there. I don't know if you can see it. So there's this writing here is the church history. And then there's a larger text coming down at an angle. And here's my best efforts at isolating it. This is an aleph. It's the end of a word. You put the word, you put an aleph at the end of lots of nouns. It's an old form of the word the article. It doesn't matter. It's a letter. And then here's the end of another word. We lost a letter right there in the middle. I'm not sure if my shadow is effective. Right there. So this is a dalet or a resh. It should have a dot here or here to distinguish it, and it's missing, or it's impossible to see. Might be right there. Mem, an O, basically, and the letter N. So here's, again, the page itself. Same spot. Totally invisible. It's right there. There's the letter M. That somehow somebody spotted this. If, I don't know. I've looked at these. I've looked at the new finds palimpsest for a lot, and I never would have seen this. So, busy slide. Don't worry about most of this. It's just worth noting that it's very little of it, but it agrees with the old Syriac against the Peshitta in ways that cannot be translated. It's a lack of grammatical, what's called a direct object marker that's missing from the Peshitta that's found in the old Syriac. Now, Kessel has subsequently found further leaves that contain the same translation in Paris and in, I think it's in Berlin. He's found two more pieces of this, and he's going to publish them all together. So we're actually going to find more of this text out in the next year or two. So we'll hopefully have some brand new readings of the old Syriac. So I can stop talking now, or I can talk about the Old Testament Peshitta for a little bit. Do you have a vote?
Ian, say a little bit more about what you found, because what you're saying there is just a word.
Yep.
But was there more, or is that word enough?
Good question.
Of significance?
So the text that is actually reconstructable is the one over here on the left. So this is what we can reconstruct. These are holes. And it's the end of Matthew chapter 13, verse 49. This is a pronouncement of woes of some kind. And he says he'll separate the evil from the righteous. There are no interesting textual variants for this part of the text. At this point, that text that was the publication I'm drawing this from, Kessel's publication, is just identifying that this fragment exists and announcing that he found other pieces of this in other libraries around the world. This Georgian liturgical text apparently was scattered. Pages of it are all over the world, and he's working to bring them together. I am told that we're going to get more new text that belongs to the same manuscript. I don't know what that contains yet. The 2017 text brought with it a bunch of new, really interesting readings, including that as if he hadn't heard line, but also there's a famous text variant around the name of the tax collector in the Gospel of Mark, and it preserves a brand new reading there that we'd never seen before that actually agrees with an old Latin manuscript. So there are interesting readings coming to light. I mean, we've had two manuscripts of this translation for over 100 years, and in the last 5 years, 10 years, we've discovered three new ones that has brought with it an explosion of new, interesting variants and readings that Bible scholars will use. I applied for this fellowship, and I'm working up there on research projects related to the Old Syriac Gospels before I knew this existed. my work doesn't actually center on this particular fragment. partially because I know someone is already editing it.
So would it be true to say that the significance of a fragment, even though it may just be a sentence?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is the cumulative
yes.
effect of many, many, many parchment fragments,
yep.
which then scholars can put together. And so this being a very early 3rd century?
Yeah. This is a 5th century copy of a 3rd century translation. So someone produced the translation in the 3rd century, and this is a early copy of that. As early as any of our other copies, pretty much. There isn't a lot of ground-shaking news, nor is that how real scholarship works. Most of the time, you know, if you want news of ground-shaking stuff, you can read these articles. But this isn't how actual scholars work. We don't really find things that it changes the world. Like, that's happened almost never. the exception to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Say a bit about that, Ian, because
yeah.
those headlines signify the way we often have this kind of almost
yeah.
conspiratorial view, you know, a hidden chapter.
Right.
And so on. And, you know, my understanding is that there's actually an extraordinary amount of
yes.
material, even though it's it divergent at points,
mm-hmm.
nonetheless there's so much
yep.
that we can have a high degree of confidence
about oh, yeah.
what we do have in our contemporary scriptures.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the aforementioned professor from North Carolina who's famous for publishing texts like Bart Ehrman, who's famous for publishing texts like Jesus Interrupted, would say that we know 90% of the text with 90% confidence. He himself has that in print. That's not up for argument. The discovery of one new manuscript, no matter what the manuscript is unlikely most of the time to change which variant reading we're going to prefer. What it does do is it sheds light on all the kinds of things I've talked to you about today. It might produce one new piece of evidence we can put on the scale for and against that anger reading. Like, I personally am split 50-50. It depends on the mood you catch me in, which of those readings, the angry Jesus or the compassionate Jesus, is probably the original one. I honestly don't know. And a great new piece of evidence like that Syriac, like, might tip someone like me. And that's great. I'm one scholar, and then a committee of scholars will vote later. Like, that's great. More interesting often is these translations. You know, discovering a new, say we discover a new early Coptic manuscript or ancient Egyptian language that agrees with the Syriac on how to translate that word daily. That's super interesting that different Greek Christians in different parts of the world are both agreeing on the same way of rendering a obviously mysterious word. That's how scholarship works. Accumulation of small little things that get put on scales that people use to evaluate and learn from. A lot of the interesting stuff isn't hidden chapters of the Bible. It's, oh, did you know Syriac Christians had a copy of the Bible that combined Codex Washingtonianus, which is in D.C., combines the two genealogies of Matthew and Luke. And there were Christians who thought, you know, you should have one big super genealogy instead. That's really cool. It's information about how this text was received, how this text was used, how Christians have thought about it throughout time, the way Christians have wanted to use their texts. That's the kind of stuff that actually shows up. And the irony here is, like, Bart, who engages in sensationalism, okay, Bart Ehrman was on my dissertation committee. He's a great human being. Gages in sensationalism, and he knows this. It's how he sells lots of books. But he agrees with most of that. I mean, I think he's wrong about all sorts of stuff. And we argue over all sorts of stuff, but he's...
Well, Ian, if you had yeah. a bit more that you wanted to present, please feel free to do that. Otherwise, we can get into wider questions.
It might be interesting to note just a few Old Testament readings that are quite interesting. Genesis 4:8, Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. If you read the footnote at the bottom of your Bible, it'll say this. Sam, which is not a person's name, that's the Samaritan Pentateuch, Greek Syriac, and the Latin Vulgate, colon, MT lax, let us go out into the field. So the manuscript that's printed in the critical edition, it's not really a critical edition, but the edition of the Old Testament that scholars use to translate, is what's called the Masoretic text. It was produced in the 10th-ish centuries. I don't have an exact date on that. 10th century. And it has a Greek, a Hebrew consonant text with vowels added to it, which are not original. They're added in by scholars. And if you read that, it says, Cain said to his brother Abel, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother. The Hebrew text that we use to translate does not have this line, let us go out into the field. But your Bibles do. For good reason. Because that's one Hebrew manuscript and the tradition that flowed out of it. If you go compare the Greek translation of that, the Syriac translation of that, and the Vulgate, the Latin translation of that, they all have this extra line. A line has dropped out of the Hebrew. And because the Hebrew scribal tradition is so famously precise and exact, they copy nonsense for over 1,000 years, sometimes for 2,000 years, and reproduce exactly that. And there are cases of this. The Hebrew text in Isaiah 53, there's some lines there that is grammatically nonsensical, and the Hebrew scribes preserve this exactly, which is super helpful, because the Masoretic text gives us a text that goes back to the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, extremely important. But it isn't the Bible that the author of Genesis first wrote down, right? And the copy that they preserved extremely faithfully isn't the authorial copy, right? It's not the copy that came off the hands of the author. And what you find here is different linguistic traditions, including the Syriac and the Latin and the Greek, all have this exact line. Nobody conspired to add this line in to three different translation traditions. This was in an underlying Hebrew text that got translated before that Masoretic text, the text we all use for our editions, was produced and then preserved faithfully for all those years. So these are witnesses to what we call the proto-Masoretic text. The biggest Bible before the Dead Sea Scrolls came around, the one that we get all of the Old Testaments come from, Old Testaments are translated out of, goes back to the 10th century. Some of our manuscripts of the Greek Hebrew Bible, of the Greek Old Testament, are from before the time of Jesus. So we have translations of the Hebrew that are older than the Hebrew. The Dead Sea Scrolls came along and showed us that the Masoretic text faithfully reproduces an extremely ancient text. The Dead Sea Scrolls also sometimes agree with these other versions, including the Syriac Peshitta, against the Masoretic text. No conspiracies, nothing secretive. We have some extremely faithful scribes producing things across the centuries, and also some extremely important witnesses to an underlying text. And this is a translation issue. I won't go into this too much, but it's another place where Genesis 4:7, God talking to Cain and Abel, if you do well, will you not be accepted? It's worth noting here, the Greek, the Latin, the Syriac, and the Hebrew adding of vowels give us, I've missed my Peshitta line, give us four different interpretations of the word. So the pre-Masoretic text, before the vowels added, gives us three consonants. Imagine having B, C, K. Could that be book? Could that be back? Could that be, that's all the words I can think of. It could be, you know, add different vowels, it could mean different things. And all four of these go with different readings. Most Bibles print the interpretation found only in the Syriac. You will be accepted. They don't go with the interpretation that's found in the Hebrew, the Greek, or the Latin. It's just a place where we can empirically say, why does the Syriac matter? Apparently my aunt asked recently, what's the point of studying Syriac? This is a place where probably the translation you have at home is following the Syriac against all the other evidence, because it makes the best sense in context. And it's an extremely ancient tradition to the interpretation of the text. Most of these translations are somewhat plausible. The Septuagint is crazy. But anyways, these are all interesting readings. Again, no conspiracies. We're trying to read a continental text, and people are reading it different ways. That's very, very normal.